So thank you very much, and thank you to the organizers for the invitation to speak. It was short notice, but it was good because I needed to write this talk up at some stage anyway, so this is good motivation. So I want to tell you a little bit about some recent developments in particle vortex duality. I should preface the talk by saying that I'm a high energy physicist, and I find low energy physics really challenging. in particular, condensed matter physicists are extremely damn prolific, and it's really hard to read two archives in the morning every morning, and especially hard when one is about three times the size of the other one. And I think that this particular aspect of high energy physics has seen so much development recently, particularly because of this interplay between low energy and high energy physics. So there have been several recent developments in particle vortex duality. In fact, there have been two new papers since I finished writing this talk, which I had to go back and edit to incorporate. So what I want to talk about is largely based on a series of papers that we've been writing with some of my graduate students and postdocs and Horacio Nastasi at the ITF in Brazil. So we've been playing around with some of these ideas since 2014. And some recent related work is by Metletsky and Vishwanath, Seiberg-Witten, Seiberg et al., Karchen Tong, Seiberg and his student, and this recent paper by David Tong and his students. And I really, really do recommend reading John's overview article that was from the APS and then what he put on the archive. It's got a lot of jokes. It's worth, it's worth reading, even for that. In particular, I want to focus on the following three papers by Horacio Nastasi, myself, and Seiberg, Senthil, Wang, and Witten, and Karchen Tong that were released at the beginning of the summer on the same day. It was Particle Vortex Day on the archive that day. And the Seiberg et al. Paper is particularly beautiful, but it's rather long. It's about 65 pages. So I thought I'd give you an executive summary of what it looks like, just to save you some of the hassle. So this is Seiberg and Witten. It's a beautiful paper. It's really worth reading just for, you know, the remarkable clarity and insight that they give. Karchen Tong are also rather elegant in their approach to the problem of particle vortex duality. And by comparison, we're kind of floundering around the outskirts. Nevertheless, I think there's something to be learned from the way we think about the problem. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about our approach to particle vortex duality. So, you know, duality is something that high energy physicists now, for the past, I guess, 15, 20 years, have been thinking about it primarily in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, a gauge gravity duality that relates quantum gravity on the one side to quantum field theories on the other side. You know, we know as high energy physicists that you take a bunch of these heavy objects like D-brains and you stick them on some background and they deform the background because they're heavy objects. And then you look at a particular limiting case of this background and you produce something that's a quantum field theory that lives on the boundary of the ADS space. We have several examples of this. ADS 5 cross S 5, N equals 4 super Yang Mills is not the only one that we understand. Recent developments have told us how to produce ADS 4 type backgrounds that are dual to Chern-Simons theories. And in fact, the gauge gravity duality has done more than that. It's given us a dictionary to map between quantum field theories and gravitational theories. So it's told us how to organize degrees of freedom on both sides of the theory so that we can say, for example, if I study an operator in the field theory that's order one in R charge, that really tells me about a point graviton living in the gravity theory. If I increase the how heavy these operators are to go to something that's order root n, then I'm really talking about strings. This was the seminal work of Bernstein, Moldesena, and Anastasi. And we learned that if we take objects that are order n, then I can deform the background enough that I'm thinking about D-brains, extended objects, like giant gravitons, also something that John had discovered. And then I can consider objects that are sufficiently large that they deform the entire background that I can't, that the probe approximation doesn't make sense anymore. And I'm talking about entirely new geometries. So these are order n squared operators, these LLM operators. So duality has been something that's been around for a long time. But this is not what I want to talk about in this talk, and this is really not where most of these new developments have been coming. What I want to talk about are what I would call low-energy dualities. These are things that are more familiar to you from, well, I guess, freshman physics even. So I'm going to start really basic, and we'll try and build up and see how far we can get in 1 hour. So starting right at the beginning with Maxwell. The Maxwell equations in vacuum, we all know, are invariant under Lorentz transformations. But also, this transformation that takes the electric field and the magnetic field to the magnetic field and minus the electric field. And I can cast this in a covariant way. So d mu f mu nu is j mu, and d mu star f mu nu is k mu. And this thing is invariant under four-dimensional electric magnetic duality that exchanges the field strength with its dual and the sources with their magnetic dual as well. It's an electric magnetic duality that takes a theory with coupling constant E to a theory with coupling constant 1 over E. Okay? At the level of Maxwell, classical Maxwell theory, this is a relatively trivial observation. But it's one that is an incredibly deep observation that has led over the years to, I guess, the forefront of the geometric Langlands conjecture. All right, so there's a lot of really deep mathematics and physics that are contained in four-dimensional electric magnetic duality. In the 1970s, Coleman, studying quantum field theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions, made the following observation, from which a lot of these discussions today will stem. So if you consider the 1 plus 1 dimensional Sine-Gordon model, defined through that action, it has the following interesting properties. There are perturbative mesons of some mass m around each of the zero energy vacua, this being a cosine potential. There are an infinite number of vacua. And around fluctuations around each of those vacua are what you would call mesons in the theory. But the theory also has solitons. These are heavy localized states in the theory that interpolate between the different vacua. And they're described by this arctan function that goes between one vacuum and the adjacent one. And these are heavy objects in the theory. And they have some mass capital M, but they also carry some topological charge. So they're topologically stable objects. And it really costs you an infinite amount of energy to deform these guys from the soliton itself to one of these zero energy states. On the other hand, again in 1 plus 1 dimensions, there is another theory called the massive Thuring model, defined by that action. And it has the property that the massless theory is full Fermi theory. This is exactly solvable for a certain range of couplings greater than pi, say. But the massive theory is not exactly solvable. Nevertheless, it has some well-defined perturbative expansion. There are no solitons in this theory, but there are perturbative fermions and fermion bound states. So here's the thing. So Coleman observed that you can bosonize the theory. You can start off with this fermionic theory and you can make a bosonic theory out of it. And the bosonization formula is quite straightforward. The fermionic states psi are related to the bosonic ones through that exponential. This is an example In fact, it was the first known example of an exact duality. It's a strong weak duality in the sense that the coupling constants for the two theories are related inversely. And it's a quantum duality that maps perturbative Green's functions of the Sine-Gordon theory, Sine-Gordon mesons, to fermion psi, psi bar bound states. And it also takes topological solitons, these kinks of the Sine-Gordon theory, that carry some topological charge, to Thuring fermions. So in this sense, you map solitons to elementary particles. But like if you read John's overview article, in some sense, this tells us that elementary particles are not really elementary. I can map them to these solitonic states that are coherent states in some sense of many such quanta. So this tells us that there's something really deep going on relating these two theories. It's a duality in the sense that it tells us how to organize degrees of freedom in the one theory to get degrees of freedom in the other theory. So in that sense, these low energy and high energy dualities are rather similar. I tend not to think about dualities in terms of holography, but rather in terms of reorganization of degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is all happening in 1+1 dimensions. But really what I want to talk about is one dimension higher. Sorry, just by the way, I'm going to be summarizing a lot of these things in this particular language. So the entire dualization can be written in this mnemonic way in these yellow boxes, which will populate this talk as we go along, right? The yellow boxes will be sweeping under the rug a lot of the details. And the further on we go, the more details, the bigger that rug becomes. So I want to talk about something that happens one dimension, one spatial dimension higher. In 2+1 dimensions, what would be called by various people in the literature, the Peskin-Dasgupta-Halperin duality, particle vortex duality, or Lee-Fisher duality. I learned about this from Lee and Fisher's seminal paper on anionic superconductivity, as well as the work by Burgess and Dolan and Burgess and Quevedo. And this is about what happens in 2+1 dimensions. So let's see if we can build up some intuition for how to think about the problem. So we'll start off by looking at the Abelian-Higgs model. So this is planar scalar electrodynamics. It consists of a complex scalar field, let's say phi, and I couple the scalar field to some U1 gauge field, a mu. And vortices in the theory are nothing but localized zeros of the complex scalar on the plane with some non-trivial winding number. As I go around these vortices, the phase of the vortex picks up some factor of 2 pi or minus 2 pi, depending on whether I'm talking about a vortex or an anti-vortex. So that's all a vortex really is. So suppose then I take the Lagrangian, I can discard any dynamics for the U1 gauge field. It doesn't play any role in the duality. and I can always tune the coefficient of the mass term to zero, so that I'm really looking at a particular IR fixed point, the Wilson-Fisher fixed point of the theory. So I take an ansatz for the vortex, this modulus phase ansatz, and I plug it into the scalar electrodynamics Lagrangian. And I can write it like that in terms of the phase. But I can also rearrange the Lagrangian in terms of some auxiliary field, which doesn't have any dynamics itself, xi mu. Then if I integrate out this xi mu field, I get back to the original problem. So this is something that's quite familiar to most of us. Again, winding around a vortex or an anti-vortex changes the phase by 2 pi or minus 2 pi. And if I take two of these vortices, a vortex and an antivortex, and I consider them separated by some distance, let's say r, then I can compute the interaction energy. So people that have worked in solitons, like Nick Manton, have done this a long time ago. And you find that the interaction energy goes like the log of the distance divided by some cutoff scale. But in 2+1, in two spatial dimensions, the Coulomb interaction also goes like the log of the separation divided by some cutoff scale. So really what this is telling us is that these localized zeros of the complex field phi kind of behave like particles separated by some two-body Coulomb interaction. So this is the first kind of hint that you would get that vortices are a little bit like particles. They have some monotomy issues as you wind around them. They kind of behave more like anions because they have to really take care of their neighbors. And if you go take one vortex around the other vortex, then it picks up this phase. But otherwise, they kind of behave like particles. So imagine we do the following. I can think of the vortex as some vector field. Right? And this vector field is allowed to have fluctuations around it. But as I go around the vortex, the vector field picks up a full factor of 2 pi, plus whatever fluctuations. The fluctuation part, I don't really care about. Right? They're kind of smooth fluctuations as I go around the vortex. But there is some vortex part of this phase angle that changes by the 2 pi. This causes the monotomy associated to the vortex. So I'll take the phase, and I'll split it up into a smooth part, just codes the fluctuations, and this vortex part that picks up the 2 pi change. Well, in that case, the Abelian-Higgs Lagrangian, in terms of this auxiliary field psi, splits up in a trivial way. If I integrate out the smooth part, this part, this gives me a constraint on what this vector psi can be. It has to be a curl in two dimensions. And if I take that and I plug it back into the Lagrangian, so I integrate out this auxiliary field, I get a completely new Lagrangian in terms of some new scalar, whose elementary quanta, in some sense, are the vortices themselves. So where the original complex field phi excitations of this field phi were the elementary particles in the theory, the charges in the theory. Excitations of this guy are really vortices in the theory, in a dual theory.
Sorry, what did you do in the last step exactly?
Right, nothing really.
Well,
that's exactly. So this is where I would normally stop.
Yes.
Right. So this is so. I can rearrange things in a way by rewriting stuff to put it in this particular form, but there isn't any natural step that goes between the two. I'll show you how you do it, writing it in terms of a path integral, which is what we'll do next. But essentially, the point I want to make here, and you know, this is just thrown in for special effects.
It's a UV completion. Right?
It is just the UV completion of the theory. Right, so good. All right, so there's another way of thinking about this in which the UV completion becomes clear. I can start off with the partition function, the path integral. Again, I can discard any dynamics for the gauge field and any self-interaction. Other than, let's say, a phi to the 4 type interaction, because I really want to consider what happens at the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So I start off with a scalar field, a complex scalar coupled to a U1 gauge field, and now I think of the gradient of the phase of that complex scalar as an independent variable in the theory. So I write that in terms of some vector. But I don't want to add in any new degrees of freedom, so I constrain that vector to be flat, essentially. So I constrain it to have vanishing curl. And then I construct a master action in some sense from this, so that if I integrate out, so I enforce the flatness of the potential through here. Through this Lagrange multiplier, B mu. So if I integrate out the Lagrange multiplier, I reproduce the original action. But on the other hand, if I integrate out the gradient of the phase factor, this lambda mu, I get some equation of motion for lambda, which if I substitute back into the master action, gives me a dual action, And the dual action is precisely the action that produces the vortices as elementary quanta of the dual theory. So the vortex current, this guy here, appears as an explicit source term in the dual action. So you'll notice that I'm contracting a completely anti-symmetric object into spatial dimensions with a symmetric second derivative, which would necessarily be zero, except at the location of the vortex itself, where the phase factor is ill-defined. So this gives you a source for the vortex current. And the duality relates the electromagnetic current to the vortex current through a relation like this. And all of these duality relations are similar. Yes?
So in your previous slide, when you were constraining the curl of mm-hmm. gradient phase to zero, you also meant that away from the location of any.
Correct. Yeah. So that will be implicit in most of what I say, is that we tend to look away from the location of the vortex itself. The Lagrange multiplier, this B mu that I inserted into the master action, is now promoted to a fully dynamical Maxwell gauge field that is dual to the phase. And the field modulus, phi naught, of the original complex scalar then plays the role of a coupling constant for this new field, B mu. So in this way, you started off with scalar electrodynamics in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and you dualized it to another theory, which, again, you can take all of this, these details and sweep it under a big yellow rug that looks like this.
Can you show again what B mu
sure.
was the Lagrange multiplier? Can you show again what B mu was the Lagrange multiplier
of this term here? So all of these details, you can essentially summarize in the following duality relation. So if you read any one of the recent papers that have come out on this topic, especially the Cyberg-Witten paper, you'll notice that there's a lot of these type of relations. And they all kind of code the same general idea. This says that a O2 symmetric Wilson-Fisher scalar is dual to the same scalar, a gauged version of the same scalar. And this is really what particle vortex duality does for you. Okay. So, as high energy theorists, we weren't really interested in the condensed matter physics to start off with. We were studying a version of the ADS-CFT correspondence called the ABJM, the ADS-4 ABJM correspondence. So this is the statement that type 2A string theory on a particular background, ADS-4 cross CP3, is dual to a supersymmetric Chern-Simons matter theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, with n equals 6 supersymmetry. And what we were trying to do was essentially realize a version of the ADS condensed matter relations in a critical string theory. So we wanted to actually start off with a string theory that we knew what the gravitational dual was, and we could write down what a field theory dual to that was. And this field theory exhibited some of the properties of the condensed matter systems that condensed matter people would be interested in. And we wanted to retain as much control over the theory as we could. So really, we wanted as much supersymmetry floating around that we could use all the non-renormalization theorems, et cetera. So this is the ABJM Lagrangian. It's not particularly enlightening, but what it is a Chern-Simons matter theory. In fact, there's two copies of Chern-Simons theory in here, one for A and one for A hat. There are two copies with level numbers K and minus K, respectively, and they're coupled to some Higgses, and there's some fermions floating around. So, you know, variants of this theory have been studied in some sense by condensed matter people, like Sylvia Sachdev, and tried to do pretty much the same thing. So we were studying this in another context. We wanted to understand, essentially, M theory. And the way we wanted to do this was, the way you get this particular duality is you start off with M2 brains, these are degrees of freedom in 11-dimensional M theory, and you put them on the tip of a cone, R2, 1 cross C4 mod ZK. And then you essentially take the limit where K goes to infinity, and that descends through a Hopf vibration to ADS4 cross CP3. And you have the dual field theory. So we wanted to understand how this worked. So we wanted to understand basically how to add finite K corrections and see D brains becoming M brains in some sense. And the one thing that kind of struck us a long time ago already was that as I turn Simon's matter theory, perhaps we could use something like level rank duality to try and explore this, because we know how to do finite n corrections, and in level rank duality, you take an SUn k level k theory and you dualize it to an SUk level l level n duality. So our naive idea at the time was perhaps we could use level rank duality to study finite k corrections and see how to sort of lift to M theory again. And like many of these things, we kind of discovered that the field theory itself was sufficiently interesting, and that's just been a big rabbit hole that we've been falling through ever since. So one of the things that we understood is that the naive way of implementing level rank duality just doesn't work in this theory. It needs to be modified in several ways that I think we're just starting to understand now, but this is through the work of Seiberg and Intelligator and a whole host of other people, including Aharoni, on how to modify level rank duality and think about these theories. But one of the things that we wanted to do was see if we could actually make some condensed matter like Lagrangians in this theory. So ABJM allows for a particular one-parameter mass deformation that breaks the R symmetry to SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 cross U1 cross some Z2. And the difference between ABJM and the mass deformation of ABJM is that in the massive theory, there's a rich spectrum of solitons that include vortices. And this is kind of how we discovered, how we learned about for the first time particle vortex duality. So by taking a particular ansatz for the Chern-Simons fields and the Higgs scalars, the ABJM, or the mass deformation, mass deformed ABJM Lagrangian can be reduced to something that looks like this. This is still of the Chern-Simons type, but the kinetic terms for the Higgs fields are both of the standard type, and because we're in three dimensions, there's some sextic self-interaction between the fields. The vortex solutions of this theory can be understood through Hanani-Witten as some D-brain configurations in the dual ADS4 cross CP3. So there's still enough control over the theory that we can start asking questions about things like particle vortex duality. So, well, one of the things that we were trying to do was embed particle vortex duality into this ABJM type setup. So one of the things that we wanted to do was produce something that looked not like Chern-Simons, but like Maxwell electrodynamics, to actually get at planar scalar electrodynamics. This is not necessary, it turns out, in the end, but this is the historical route that we decided to go with. In any event, the point being here that there exists a mechanism that allows you to go from a topological theory to something that exhibits Maxwell dynamics that was written down by Mookie and Papageorgakis, again in the context of M-theory, that allows us to embed particle vortex duality into this ABJM setup. The details of this is not particularly relevant for this audience, but it can be embedded into ABJM. I would like to come to something more relevant, which is the way we think about particle vortex duality now, especially in the context of condensed matter physics. And in particular, the condensed matter physics of the half-filled Landau level problem. So, and I can recommend Dam Son's recent article of, I think, a day or two ago, in which he summarizes most of these developments. But much of this started with a particular conjecture of Son's of 2015. At least this is why we started thinking about the problem again. So here's the thing. There's a niggling problem on the plane, which is that if you take a system of non-relativistic particles with some two-body interaction, let's say Coulomb-like interaction, then that system exhibits parity and time symmetry. So these are two discrete symmetries exhibited by this system of non-relativistic particles. And then if you turn on a uniform B field, say, the resulting system exhibits PT symmetry. But if you take that system and you project it down to the lowest Landau level, there's another symmetry that emerges, a discrete symmetry. That's particle hole symmetry. The problem is that particle hole symmetry is not a symmetry of the Halperin, Lee, Reed effector field theory of the lowest Landau level. So the HLR effector field theory doesn't exhibit particle hole symmetry. And in particular, and I really quite appreciated the pun, if you look at the half-filled Landau level problem, there is a difference between the glass half-full and the glass half-empty. Right? And whatever effective field theory that you write down to describe the system needs to preserve all the phenomenological niceness of the HLR theory, but be manifestly particle hole symmetric. So the question is, how do you do that? How do you describe this, this system that exhibits this particle hole symmetry on the lowest Landau level? Well, Sun came along with the following proposal in 2015, and this proposal has really stimulated an enormous amount of work in the area, and said that the composite fermion picture of this lowest Landau level physics problem, the composite fermion should be considered as a massless Dirac fermion, which under particle hole conjugation transforms from psi, where psi is a composite fermion, to I sigma 2 psi. So this is a little bit like the way we think of time symmetry in the plane. So this gives you a new effector field theory for the Landau level problem. And you could ask, well, how do you visualize what this composite fermion looks like? And Son's conjecture is that the composite fermion should be interpreted as a kind of fermionic vortex that arises from a fermionic version of the particle vortex duality that we spoke about in the previous slides. So this was suggested in Son's paper of 2015 and explored and really cemented through a remarkable paper by Metlitsky and Vishwanath in 2016. And this is what we spent a large chunk of 2016 trying to understand. For one, what do you mean by a fermionic vortex? And we were really thinking in terms of that scratching picture that I gave you at the beginning. So we tend to think about particle vortex duality in terms of this on-shell statement that maps that maps vortex states to particle states in the theory. This is, of course, a duality transformation that can be done at the level of a conformal field theory. So it's an entirely off-shell statement, which we learned from speaking to Seiberg and Witten. But at this time, we were trying to take a theory that had vortices, fermionic vortices, and see if we could map it to another theory with Dirac fermions. So the question is, what exactly is a fermionic vortex? And it turns out that fermionic vortex, at least the type that Vitlitsky and Vishwanath were talking about, is not really a fermionic vortex so much as a vortex fermion bound state. So these are fermionic zero modes that are trapped in the core of the vortex. And the particle vortex duality, this fermionic particle vortex duality, dualizes that system of the fermion vortex bound state, which is a really difficult thing to execute at the level of what we were talking about previously. Okay. Nevertheless, it gave an intuitive picture for how to view the composite fermion that Son was proposing, describes the half-filled lowest Landau level system. So we spent the better part of the beginning of this year trying to understand how to dualize this problem. And in the end, it turns out that particle vortex duality, the bosonic particle vortex duality, as well as this new fermionic version of particle vortex duality that Mitlitsky and Vishwanath were studying, is part of a significantly bigger web of dualities that take place in 2+1 dimensions. Essentially, the key idea of all of these things comes down to three-dimensional bosonization. So the same 1+1 dimensional story that took you between the massive Thuring model and the Sine-Gordon model in 1+1 dimensions that mapped solitons to elementary quanta can be extended modulo a whole bunch of caveats, can be extended to 2+1 dimensions. And you can bosonize fermionic theories in 2+1 dimensions. And this was done by a couple of people, essentially two separate groups, Shaposnik and Fradkin from the condensed matter side, and Burgess and Quevedo from the high energy side. I think there's something like a month difference between the two sets of papers. But here's another example of high energy and low energy physics kind of doing exactly the same thing in a slightly different language. So the key idea here is three-dimensional bosonization. So the overall story is rather remarkable, and there's a lot of details that you can skip over if you choose, for example, to set the rank of your gauge group as well as the number of flavors of the fields in your theory, as well as the Chern-Simons level number to 1. In which case, the overall structure of these dualities take the following form. The three types of dualities, one that maps a fermion couple to a U1 level minus a half Chern-Simons field to a scalar. A free fermion maps to a scalar coupled to a U1 Chern-Simons field with level number 1, and a fermion coupled to a level minus 3/2 Chern-Simons field to a scalar coupled to a level 2 abelian Chern-Simons field. So all of these dualities take that particular structure. They're part of a bigger structure that involves dualities between Chern-Simons matter theories that were elucidated in a beautiful paper by Ofer Arani in 2016. but for the purposes of this talk, I will do what Seiberg and company do in their paper and set n equals k equals nf equals 1. So it turns out that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you have this web of dualities, which there are a number of technical details that involve the manifold over which you do this, being a spin manifold or not. But overall, the following is true. There are three types of dualities here. This is a boson to boson duality. This is the standard particle vortex duality that takes this O2 Wilson-Fisher boson to a gauged Wilson-Fisher boson. This is essentially Sun's proposal. This is essentially Sun's proposal, which takes you between a fermion and a fermion, massless Dirac fermion. This is the technically precise way of stating it in terms of all the different fields that play a role in the duality. And this here is a duality that takes you between a fermion and a boson. And the structure of the duality is such that if you assume any one of those three dualities, you can prove the other two. But you have to start somewhere, and you assume one of them. Seiberg and Witten and Cartin Tong start off by making an argument for this being the starting point, essentially bosonization that takes you between a fermion and a boson. And from there, you can derive both the fermionic particle vortex duality as well as a standard bosonic particle vortex duality. And again, since this work at the beginning of June this year, there's been a number of different results that have tried to put this on a firmer footing. One such result is whether you can actually derive these dualities from a supersymmetric statement. The problem is the following. All of these dualities are strictly bosonic dualities, which you explore just at the IR fixed points, which is all well and good, but because there's no supersymmetry around, you don't have much of the protection that supersymmetry affords you. So proving these dualities are extremely difficult. However, there are supersymmetric versions of what this duality should be, and the supersymmetric story here is what goes by the name of three-dimensional mirror symmetry, which Intelligator and Seiberg and collaborators have been working on for a long, long time now. So the question is, could you derive these bosonic dualities from a supersymmetric three-dimensional mirror symmetry? So in the last couple of days, Shamit Kachru and some of his collaborators have showed that you can actually derive all three of these dualities plus one new one starting from n equals 4 mirror symmetry in three dimensions by starting off with a supersymmetric theory and then breaking the supersymmetry in a very controlled way by adding some background D-term mapping three-dimensional mirror symmetry to some chiral supersymmetric duality and then allowing the chiral supersymmetric duality to flow to these bosonic dualities. So it seems that, you know, you can use supersymmetry to put these bosonic dualities on a more rigorous footing. We had been asking another question, which is, can we go away from this n equals k equals nf equals 1 abelian web of dualities story and non-abelianize the duality? Again, our thinking was slightly different from the way we understand it right now, which is actually trying to work with particle and vortex states in an on-shell statement about the duality. So we started off by thinking not in terms of this web of dualities, but several years ago in terms of non-abelian T-duality. So T-duality, the standard abelian T-duality that you would be familiar from elementary string theory courses. That might be an oxymoron, but this is a symmetry of the perturbative string path integral. And I can implement this as a duality transformation on the world sheet by acting on some set of commuting isometries. So way back when, Della Ossa and Quevedo, and then Rochek and Valinde asked the following question. Can you generalize this to non-abelian isometries? So what you normally do is you take the maximal set of commuting isometries, so something like a U1 to the N, and you dualize along this thing, and you get the standard picture of T-duality. So suppose you did what you would do for bosonization, except you do it for the 1 plus 1 dimensional world sheet of the string. So you want to gauge some global SU2 symmetry, say, by the standard procedure of taking your partial derivatives to a gauge covariant derivative. You then constrain the gauge field to be trivial by imposing some flatness condition, F equals 0. And you do it by imposing some, by inserting some Lagrange multiplier type term. So here, this V is a Lagrange multiplier that imposes that F must equal to 0. So you don't actually want to introduce any new degrees of freedom. You just want to constrain. You want to constrain the gauge field to be trivial. And then, if you integrate out the Lagrange multiplier, you get the original action. But if you integrate out the new this gauge field, you'll get a new theory, and this theory will be the T-dual theory. So this is one way of thinking about standard string theoretic T-duality. And the intermediate step, written in a set of variables, which, again, not particularly enlightening, but the overall, that algorithm is important, is this master action. Again, if you integrate out the Lagrange multiplier, you will get the original theory. If you integrate out the new gauge field, you will get the dual theory, the T-dual theory. And in terms of these variables, this looks like this. Not particularly important. What is important, though, is that implementing non-abelian T-duality is highly non-trivial, even in this 1 plus 1 dimensional story. And there's well-known issues with the global properties of the theory, as well as the coordinate ranges of the various coordinates involved in the system. To the end that, basically, following the Rochek-Valinde paper, non-abelian T-duality was more or less relegated to the corners of string theory that nobody really cared about, until recently. And what happened recently is that we learned how to repackage the theory and write it in a way that allows us to view non-abelian T-duality as a solution-generating transformation. So we thought, well, could we do that with one dimension higher in a 2 plus 1 dimensional system and use essentially the sort of advances in non-abelian T-duality to generalize particle vortex duality to a non-abelian version?
So for usual T-duality, that is, the picture I have is a geometric picture in which, let's say, a circle goes to a different circle. Can you give me a geometric example of a non-abelian T-duality?
Not so much, no. But you know, the simplest case is if you let's say gauge an SU2, and then the geometric picture is not as clear in this setting. So we said, okay, could we try and understand particle vortex duality in 2 plus 1 dimensions by lifting non-abelian T-duality from 1 plus 1 dimensions? Again, the procedure is the same. You insert some Lagrange multiplier, you gauge some global group, in this case SU2, just for simplicity. Insert the Lagrange multiplier, and then if you integrate out the Lagrange multiplier, it allows you to gauge away the new gauge field. If you integrate out the gauge field, you get a dual theory. So the master action in this sense, in this case, looks like this. Phi naught is, again, the in this case, non-abelian vortex field. And you go through pretty much the same story. And you find that, yes, indeed, it is possible to generalize the particle vortex duality to a non-abelian particle vortex duality. The question, though, for us at this stage was, is this really a particle vortex duality in the sense that does it actually map non-abelian vortices to some non-abelian states in the theory? And to do that, you need to know what a non-abelian vortex state looks like in the theory. Unfortunately, there are not many people that know that have been able to construct non-abelian vortices. Misha Schiffman and his collaborators are about the only groups that I'm, and David Tong and his students, about the only groups that I'm familiar with. But implementing these this non-abelian particle vortex duality has been particularly difficult. One example where we were able to do it was in what's called semi-local vortices. So these are topological defects in actually 2+1 dimensions that have both local and global symmetries. I can extend them trivially to 3+1 dimensions, in which case they become what cosmologists would call semi-local strings. These are generalizations of standard cosmic strings. Unlike cosmic strings, however, these solutions can exist even if the vacuum manifold is simply connected. In our example, we have an SU2 global symmetry crossed with some U1 local symmetry. The scalar field phi transforms in the fundamental of the flavor group, and at critical coupling, lambda equals 1, the theory exhibits some self-dual Bogomolny vortices of the standard type that you will encounter in any elementary course on solitons. So it's not quite non-abelian particle vortex duality. The flavor group goes from, the number of flavors goes from 1 to 2. So in that sense, we've generalized the theory, but it's not what we wanted to do. However, this ansatz, this particular ansatz, which you would take the standard vortex ansatz for the theory, is compatible with what we needed in our formal treatment of particle vortex, non-abelian particle vortex duality. And you can turn the handle and crank out a dual theory, which is not particularly simple to write down, but nevertheless, there's a duality that maps particles and vortices in the following way. It's exactly the same as what you would expect for the abelian case that relates the currents, the electromagnetic current to the vortex current. So this is the way we were thinking about the problem circa mid-2015. However, since the discovery of this two-dimensional web, it's become apparent that there are better ways to think about the problem. And those better ways involve starting off with a non-abelian version of three-dimensional Bosonization, and in particular, the idea of flux attachment, and building from there. So this is ongoing work in progress with Horacio Nastasi and some people at the Institute. And let me finish by pointing out that this is very much an active area in both high and low dimensional, high and low energy physics. It's an incredible story that's evolving at a rather rapid pace that involves things like topological insulators, topological superconductors, the fractional quantum Hall effect, mirror symmetry, non-abelian anions, the quantum Hall effect. We don't understand what goes on at finite temperature because there are holonomy issues with dualizing along the thermal circle. Anion superconductivity, and there's an enormous amount of interplay between high and low energy physics, all of which I find particularly challenging. So, thank you.
Questions for Jeff?
Yeah, so regarding the particle duality at low level. So, if I understand correctly, it's something that is there only for the lowest one, but it's not there for the excited one.
Yeah.
And
the particle Hall symmetry, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it sounds it's discrete, but it sounds like an accidental a low energy accidental symmetry in the same sense as, I don't know, baryon hundred the standard model. And so the question is, how do you see that at the level of the effective theory?
Right. So the effective field theory for the physics of the lowest lambda level is the Halperin-Lee-Reed theory. And the problem is that The physics of the HLR theory is not really, how to put this? In particular, the half-filled Lewis Landau level problem is a problem for how the HLR theory treats it in terms of the particle hole symmetry. So for one, you would expect that if I've got this, I think in terms of Fermi droplets, and I would expect that charge conjugation, particle hole conjugation takes me from the particle to the hole state of the theory. Whereas in the HLR theory, this accidental symmetry, as you point out, is not there. So the question is, how do you see this symmetry of the theory? Either the particle hole symmetry is broken in some way, but the problem is that there's no experimental evidence supporting that there's this spontaneous symmetry breaking of particle hole symmetry in the HLR theory, or HLR theory is particle hole symmetric, but in some hidden way. I can't remember what the problem. Do you remember what the issue with? Apart from why would it be? Okay, good. So that's the one that has. It's an experimental fact that there is no hidden particle hole symmetry in the HLR.
There really is particle hole symmetry in the Heffel-Landau
level. In the Heffel-Landau level, yes, but in the HLR theory, there is so. If I remember correctly, Son makes an argument for there being three options. One is particle hole symmetry is hidden in HLR. Two is that it's spontaneously broken. And three is that you need to replace the effective theory with this composite fermion picture. And the composite fermion picture has the same phenomenology as the HLR theory, except that it is, no?
There's a lot of overlap.
I guess, fine. So I guess technically the correct statement is that there's a lot of overlap between the phenomenology of the HLR effective theory and the composite fermion picture, except that in addition, in the composite fermion picture, you can implement particle hole duality. But I guess the statement is that it's not there as a symmetry of the HLR effective theory of the lowest lambda level, but it is present in the lowest lambda level experimentally. Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff, again.